welcome to this, the first episode in the 2021 season of the Talk Data to Me podcast. This episode was recorded with me sitting by the side of the road, so there are some moments of background noise caused by large heavy goods vehicles rattling past. As we start this podcast, you'll hear me introducing my co-hosts for the day, Kerry Lenning and Catherine O'Keefe.
Catherine.
Hi. Having some fun reviewing UK adequacy decision discussion and actual data protection processing agreements for processors in the UK right now. So things have gotten busy very quickly when it comes to the reality of what Brexit looks like.
Fantastic. And Kerry, do you want to introduce yourself to our listeners? Because some of them mightn't have met you before.
No, I think most of them probably haven't met me because I'm still, you know, I'm a Yank and that sort of a thing. So I was brought in a little bit not too long ago and very excited to be here. But I come from California. I'm like Catherine. We're lovely Americans, and yet the Irish folks still seem to accept us. And I have a background in both cybersecurity and data protection. So I'm kind of a dual-edged sword. I was a former, or as they say, recovering attorney, and also, you know, in tech and everything else. So I have a weird, weird little background of what I know or don't
Fantastic.
Know.
Yeah. Another example of Castlebridge, finding the jigsaw pieces that don't quite fit anywhere else and making them fit into our little jigsaw, which is great. So the running order for today, lots of things to talk about. We could really just like talk for 3 days solidly about the various things we could talk about today. But the key things that are on the list, we've got the UK and Brexit and the recently announced draft adequacy decision, which I forecast will have the life expectancy of a snowball in a very hot place. We also have Clubhouse, and we have the fundamentals here that a lot of this is just basic good data management and good data governance, and these things need to be looked at and thought about coherently and cohesively. So that's the general gist of the topics we're talking about. But let's launch into the Brexit and adequacy decision discussions. Adequacy is going to happen, or
I think I might expand our snowball metaphor and actually say, as a simile, it's more like a Texas snowstorm, and that it might land and cause a hell of a lot of damage and confusion and then be gone very quickly, leaving the damage and confusion behind.
Oh, and will anyone declare bankruptcy like just happened in the Texas snowstorm? Sorry, I'm making Texas jokes. As a Californian, I think I'm entitled to make jokes about Texas.
I'm with you there. With all sympathy to the poor sods who have to live there with that horrendous governance structure that's going on.
Yeah, good times. Yeah.
Ladies, let's stay on message. We're talking about adequacy of data protection, not adequacy of the of one of the states in the lower 48.
That's fair.
That is fair.
Definitely adequacy, I think, is interesting. So I did a quick read through of the draft adequacy decision that came out, and I was struck by the fact that, you know, obviously this thing is just a political game, because I think a lot of this is just, you know, everyone realizing that everyone's going to be in a world of hurt in the UK side and, to be honest, on the EU side if adequacy isn't granted. I did want to give a shout out, though, you know, to the folks in the EC in the sense that they at least did a solid job of organizing their thoughts and explaining their rationale. I mean, it's a fairly long read, right? And but they go through and they talk a lot about, you know, what is in place. And, you know, even though there is a lot of bulk collection and there's the Five Eyes issues and concerns and the fact that the UK has signed on with the US as far as the Cloud Act, which is not great. They do have a lot of safeguards and redress that other inadequate regimes do not. So it's worth at least giving, you know, some fair shake that there is something there and it's better than nothing. But yeah.
That's a good point as far as their rationale, but I think that rationale will be challenged very quickly. A couple years ago, at one of the CPDP conferences, there was a panel, very high-level panelists talking about surveillance in the U.S. and in the EU at the time. And one of the panelists was from the UK and had seen a lot of oversight. And his argument was actually that the US had better oversight measures than the UK did. So one of the big red flags that's going to be happening with this potential adequacy decision is we're immediately going to be getting a protest and objection from the US saying, well, all these things that you say that the UK has, they're no better than we are, or we are better than them. So give us adequacy, too.
The U.S. doesn't have human rights, though. Remember that. Like, they don't have any kind of, you know, convention on human rights that they follow.
But so there is trying to get very much out of that themselves as well. So,
That's true.
And that was one of the premises and pretexts for Brexit.
Right. And that's one of the key things. When I spoke at CPDP a couple of years ago on Brexit issues back in 2017, I talked about regulatory divergence post-Brexit as the key thing to watch. And what I said on that panel was that there would quite possibly be an adequacy decision early on, but that over time we would need to keep an eye on the divergence, particularly through the use of secondary legislation in the UK. Now, the draft adequacy decision from the European Commission is predicated on the very simple presumption that nothing in the UK is going to change.
Right.
And over the weekend, we had the minister from the Department of Culture, Media and Sport in the UK, the minister responsible for data protection in the UK, writing an op-ed in the Financial Times where he used his inside voice as his outside voice and said the secret bit out loud about how they wanted to seize this opportunity to reform legislation around the use of data in the UK to enable them to compete with the EU.
Right.
Now,
and Boris has said similar things too. So yeah, that doesn't help. And Hancock, for that matter.
That's the bit in the James Bond movie where the guy with the cat tells James Bond his plan. And everyone goes, ah, yes, we saw that plan. We know that's the plan. And it tends not to end well for the bad guy with the cat. And that's what we're seeing with adequacy here, is that on one hand, they're saying, we're going to stand up and agree to these things, and this is what will be done. And the European Commission is saying, on the basis of this thing being something that they are going to commit to, we might be able to swing an argument for adequacy. But then on the other hand, we see the reality. And being Irish, being the token Irishman on the panel today, the Brits, they do be at it again, one fears.
I have to protest, I'm also Irish. I am both. But yes, the Brits are definitely at it again, and we're seeing the same types of don't look behind the curtain rhetoric we have been seeing for the past 5 or 6 years when it came to everything else relating to Brexit. So I guess we're supposed to be surprised when things fall apart, when the exact same thing that they said was going to happen happened.
Yeah, surprise Pikachu face all the way around, obviously.
Mm-hmm. But, surprise Pikachu face, exactly. Yeah. Like that. That's why I, for the Law Society Certificate of Data Protection course 2 weeks ago, I used a slide of Charlie Brown and Lucy from Peanut Strip to explain what was going to happen with the Brexit adequacy decision. As anyone who has ever read the Peanuts comic strips will know that Lucy always puts the ball in front of Charlie Brown and then snatches it away at the last minute. In this case, Lucy is the European Court of Justice. The ball is the adequacy decision from the European Commission, and Charlie Brown is the European Commission, who is kicking yet again at the ball to get the exact same result that they got the last two times. Safe Harbor and Privacy Shield, we have had these issues examined, which means when they do come to the Court of Justice, there is a limited amount of wriggle room for the Commission in this context. And one of the former judges, Danowitz, was talking at an event in the last few weeks where he made this same point that the case law from the European Court of Justice is increasingly clear and it needs to be taken into consideration in any of these decisions. But we will see what happens. Maybe doing the same thing over again to expecting different results isn't the definition of insanity.
Well, the one thing that is worth considering is that they're at least building in some controls so that the duration of adequacy is for a finite period of time. You know, it goes back to what you were saying about, like, if this is presuming that the UK doesn't decide to nullify the, you know, Good Friday Accord or all the other things that they keep proposing that they're going to do.
What we now know about adequacy is that the European Commission has proposed an adequacy decision that will be valid for a period of up to 4 years or until Tuesday, whichever comes first.
And this is just introducing more confusion and uncertainty for all the people trying to actually sign data processing agreements and figure out whether they can use processors in the UK. So that's a lot of not fun for the people who are actually trying to do business.
Right.
Yeah, and this brings us to the wonderful world of standard contractual clauses and the Schrems II aftermath and Brexit. All together.
Oh, standard contractual clauses. Yeah, that's going to be fun. I anticipate that there will be another, you know, Court of Justice decision around this because they, you know, first one didn't, in my opinion, really clearly define things. And also, you know, the reliance that the court continues to have on pseudonymization and encryption, I think, is so wildly misplaced, and technology is going to come and remind them of that over the next couple of years. But, you know, I think all of these things are sort of by design. Like, the, you know, the European Commission is coming at this from a political standpoint, and that's the same as the US, right? You know, they come at this on a political thing, and then they wait for the courts to come in and be the bad guy. So I think this is somewhat a by design thing, and they know that maybe this is going to get, the football is going to get taken away by the Court of Justice at some point, but they're okay with that because they're politicians and they just don't want to look bad.
The European Commission, the Charlie Brown of the comitology process.
As far as the politicians not wanting to look bad question, the question is what they've decided is looking bad. Is it, you know, do we never want to say anything bad about our potential allies, or is it, are we going to look like we actually mean what we say when it comes to fundamental human rights?
No, it's that they don't want to look like they've completely single-handedly effed over the economy, right? It's all of the business and the data flows aspects that they are trying not to look bad about. No one wants to be the guy that says, nah, you have to stop everything that you're doing and do all this onerous extra BS. They want to, you know, look like they're playing ball and then have someone else maybe come in and do that.
Yeah,
that's my cynical view, obviously, but yeah.
That is a cynical realpolitik of the whole thing. The commission being political deals in the art of the possible, and the European Court of Justice deals in the art of what is actually legal. Right. That's where the gap needs to be bridged. But standard contractual clauses, Catherine, we're looking at data processor agreements for clients at the moment, with the UK, where processors are in the UK or where they're working on joint controller agreements with organizations in the UK. How are we finding it?
Everyone's waiting for the potential draft standard contractual clauses to actually be finalized. So everyone's in limbo right now when it comes to the SCCs. And there's an extra bit of confusion involved there because the commission drafted not only standard contractual clauses for cross-border data transfers to third countries, which is what we usually think when we say standard contractual clauses, but they've also developed draft contracts that they also call standard contractual clauses, which are basically draft data processor agreements. So it's an extra bit of confusion, particularly if you try to find the draft documents on the joint EDPS and EDPB websites. If I remember correctly, they have opinions on them, joint opinions, and trying to find the opinions on one thing versus the other thing makes things very confusing for businesses. And I'm seeing a lot of resulting confusion, not just from that, but from the the practical aspects of Brexit and updating contracts on the part of data processors, particularly in the UK. So I was reviewing a contract this afternoon, and I was looking at the definitions set at the beginning of the processor agreement, and they defined GDPR as both the, quote, UK GDPR, which took effect on January 31st, 2020, as well as the EU GDPR. And they're two completely separate pieces of legislation, and there is an assumption there that they will not only be the same but remain the same, and we cannot trust that assumption. And I'm also seeing bits that are taken from the old agreement that guarantees data will be only processed within the EEA when we're talking about a UK-based processor that is by definition not within the EEA. So there's a lot of confusion going on. If you're looking at contracts, if you're looking at making any sort of agreement between processors or joint controller relationships, you need to be very, very careful and go through any agreements with a fine-tooth comb at this point.
Carrie, what do you think on that? Have you seen similar?
Well, I haven't had to do too much in the way of SECs, thank God. But the thing that I'm more curious of is who wants to place bets on when they're actually going to come out of the draft mode and actually be, you know, finalized. You know, we had standard contractual clauses going back for 10 years, right? You know, since the last, you know, up until this current set of revisions. I'm just curious to see, you know, I think a lot of companies, when I've talked to clients about this, that, you know, everyone's kind of sitting and waiting because the draft stage just, they recognize it doesn't cut it until, you know, something is actually finalized. And so the approach is, well, Pinky, we're just crossing our fingers, hoping that, you know, regulators won't step in and do something in the interim, but we don't really want to sign anything until we either absolutely have to or until the thing gets finalized. So I don't know. When do you guys think all of this is going to get ironed out and to a point where businesses feel comfortable?
My view is we have an entire Clark's shoe shop full of other shoes about to drop, and we're waiting for them. And this is the difficulty we face, because the redraft of the standard contractual clauses was something that was in pipeline for years and was accelerated after Schrems II. And right. the opinions from the EDPS and the EDPB on the draft clauses has raised a number of key issues in terms of their structure and what they do. And the Catherine's point there about there being two different documents, both called standard contractual clauses, I predict that when they are finalized, we're going to find organizations picking the wrong document.
Absolutely.
And that may lead to unintended consequences. But even before that, when we look at the basics of data processor agreements under GDPR, we're well beyond the point where the templates people bought for a few hundred euros from the online Templates or Us website, we all know where they are. Let's face it, we've all used them at some point. Those standard form templates are no longer good, and this highlights the importance of having knowledgeable consultants or advisors to actually look at your documentation carefully and understand what it's saying, but also looking beyond that at the safeguards and controls that the document says will be in place and making sure they're actually there. We're dealing with that at the moment with a client where we've asked, the client has requested an audit from a data processor, and We're waiting to see how that one pans out at the moment. But it seems to be the first time the supplier has actually been asked by a controller for an audit.
Yeah.
A bit of a shock. And is it in the contract? My answer is it doesn't matter really if it's in the contract or not. If it's explicitly spelled out in the contract, it's there in Article 28 as a thing that you as a processor must be willing to sign up to.
Yep.
That right of audit's important. And if you're not willing to show the person who's paying the bill how the shop works, maybe the person paying the bill will go to a different shop. This is where we get into the wonderful world of the fundamentals of governance and data management. This is not a thing we solve a contract at the end of the day. This isn't something we can plaster over with well-wordsmithed, carefully honed clauses. We actually have to deal with the messiness of the data at the end of the day. And That's where organizations are struggling.
Although with the contracts, what I'm finding in them is a lot of them are red flags that this particular organization is not actually competent enough in understanding what they're doing to do the due diligence, to have the management and governance required to be able to do the right things with data.
Yeah, and that's a red flag. The gaps in a data process agreement, potential resistance to an audit, unwillingness to demonstrate the evidence behind assertions that are being made by a data processor about how things are being handled is always a concern, because that indicates there might be something missing from the point of view of the organizational governance and controls. And that's why organizations, and we worked at a couple of organizations that are data processors. I've actually wrote about it on a blog post last week. In the past, we've dealt with processors who were dealing with clients of ours who were acting as their DPO. And when they were asked due diligence questions, they didn't have an answer to them and couldn't provide an answer. And either they got stroppy about it, or they sucked it up and actually worked with our client as the data controller to understand what the questions were and how they should be answered. And the really clever ones took that learning and turned it into a standard template response they could give to anyone. And the clients we worked with, one of our retail clients, commented that those suppliers who actually engaged with the process and understood it to be a learning experience on both sides, it helped the client improve their processes and understand their suppliers better. And it helped the supplier shorten their sales cycle when they were dealing with other prospective buyers of their product.
Exactly.
That's just good governance. And all the data says it shortens your sales cycle, so why don't you do it? Digging your heels in and pissing around, pardon my language, because no one else has asked you those questions before? That's nice. It's a learning opportunity for everyone, really, isn't it?
I wish I could say I was surprised at this, but from the cybersecurity, information security standpoint, this kind of practice is so standard, it is silly. I mean, I have clients that we're dealing with right now who are dealing with a vendor who is just basically telling them to piss off, and they know they can because no one, there's no teeth basically to stop them, or at least up until, currently, and in the US there's definitely no teeth. But, it doesn't surprise me that that vendors push back and say, well, we haven't done this before and we're not going to do it. What surprises me is that, you have clients, and I was deeply impressed with the fact that there was a recent client of Castle Bridges who actually does push back. I honestly was just overjoyed. I was like, oh, you guys are actually listening. Oh, you're actually telling the vendor to piss off when they're not doing what they're supposed to do. It was delightful.
Many of our clients have heard me sigh in dismay on the end of a conference call, so they know what's coming next if they don't push back. But that clients that grasp that realize, and again, talking to Michelle Dennerty and a few other people about this sort of stuff over the past couple of weeks, particularly with Clubhouse, which we'll come to in a moment, a buyer who doesn't do that due diligence and who accepts that they're getting a particular bill of sale and bundle of goods from a vendor and is willing to accept caveat emptor needs to bear in mind that they're buying the risk. They're not buying the process at that point. They're buying the risk that right. The other side is doing everything right, but won't show them how. And in a market where you're a monopoly, that is something you can possibly get away with as a supplier. If you got competitors, they're lean and hungry and they're going after your business. And if they're smart, they're going to start competing on privacy. They're going to start competing on making it easy for risk managers, data protection officers, chief risk officers, data governance managers to be able to demonstrate that they have controls in place. The market is shifting. And while right. the regulatory teeth mightn't be there, the law of voting with two feet is there, and the checkbook wins at the end of the day. And that's where I think we're beginning to see an interesting shift happening in the market, simply because from a governance perspective, let's park the regulatory aspects for a moment. The simple auditor lands in on us in the morning as the company that has bought these services. Can we produce a piece of paper that says we asked these questions and got answers that we felt we could live with? And right. That is driving change. And we've had clients doing this on procurement for a couple of years as part of GDPR preparation. And some of them push back, some of them don't. Some of them have found wonderful situations where they've wound up collaborating with suppliers to figure out how to make the technology work or to change the technology to make sure that it eliminates or minimizes risk. And it's improved the product for the supplier at minimal cost with a customer who is willing to engage in the design process. And that's a good thing. But if you are a big player and you're simply saying, no, we don't talk to the little people pay the wages at the end of the day. And the market is shifting. Which brings us to Clubhouse, because I'm going to pass the time here. We've been talking here for about 25 minutes, and I do want to talk about Clubhouse before we finish, because, oh boy.
Because it's a mess.
There's a poster child for going out with a product into the market that has decided it's not going to look at any of the things people need to do to actually have a proper product.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of slightly smug that I managed to get the first media commentary on why Clubhouse is a completion or train wreck into the Irish media in the last few weeks by calling out Jess Kelly on News Talk when she was telling people about it and saying, do you want to know why I don't use it? And Jess was great. She had me on her Tech Talk show last week to talk about it. And that I'll put a link to that in the information page for this podcast. But Kerry, am I wrong? Is Clubhouse just misunderstood?
Oh God, no! You know my thoughts on Clubhouse. So I think me and Deborah Farber and Alexander Hanf, I always say his name wrong. I think we should all just have a big party. You guys can come too, where we talk and just bitch about Clubhouse. And you know, honestly, Clubhouse.
Well, the Future Privacy Foundation had one of those on Clubhouse.
Oh right? Sweet God!
Audio-based media social about how audio-based social media sucks.
I was so, you know, I love Jules and I have massive amounts of respect for the Future Privacy Foundation. But my God, when I saw that, and I've seen so many privacy professionals touting Clubhouse, and I'm like, are you all mad? Have you all just been doing the same drugs? Because what is going on here? I look at everything in the Clubhouse thing, and they take such a laissez-faire approach to privacy. They didn't even have their privacy policy on their website. They were hosting it on Notion.io. And I cannot wrap my head around it. Like, I did my most popular LinkedIn post to date is the fact that I just lost my mind with the fact that all these companies are hosting their privacy policies not on their website. They can't be ours to do that. They're hosting it somewhere else. But Clubhouse's was just so egregious. And the fact that there's, known issues with their security, known issues with how they're dealing with storing and sharing data, the fact that they don't have any real encryption in place, it is a minefield. And yet no one is really thinking about it. And I think they're doing that because the one thing I think Clubhouse did right was they created this exclusive club atmosphere. It's just like Facebook. They went in, they said, only you and you and your besties can show up on Clubhouse, and all the rest of those clubs, they're out of luck. You know, you have to be invited. So you have this fear of missing out thing. And they've totally capitalized on the psychology that people don't want to miss out on a thing. And while they're doing that, you know, these people aren't thinking about the privacy concerns. They're thinking about how cool they are because they got an invite.
Gotta love social manipulation. Yeah, I think comparing it to what Facebook did is absolutely correct. Of course, Gmail did that to begin with as well, too. You know, oh, we're in beta. You have to get an invite to use it. It's a known marketing tool. And it's something that we should be able to recognize easily enough at this point, but it's worth pointing out every time they do it, But yeah, Facebook, you know, move fast and break things. It seems Clubhouse has taken that to the Kool-Aid levels of break through the wall and smash everything very quickly.
Yeah.
The way I described it to a friend was that Clubhouse is a social media app that has fallen through a crack in time from around about 2004 in terms of its approach to its architecture, its controls, its governance, and privacy. It appears that they haven't even paid attention to things that happened in the last 12 months with a small, certain, up-and-coming video conferencing provider that this time last year was getting reamed for very similar things in terms of its architecture and security, its controls around privacy, all these things that people were rightly concerned about. And then Clubhouse arrives, and it's as if Zoom never happened, Facebook never happened, Twitter never happened, and Gmail never happened in terms of its project. The one thing that really gets me is the part of the exclusivity is the ranking, where they ingest your contacts and then they rank how many of your contacts are on their platform and how popular those contacts are. So you can see that you're not only in an exclusive club, you're hanging out with exclusive people who know lots of other exclusive people. But the ingestion of contacts from your contact list, that's illegal under EU law. A huge amount of stuff that Clubhouse is doing is illegal under the European Communications Code and the e-privacy directives. And they're looking for $1 billion. The last time I saw someone with something that evil looking for $1 billion, it was a laser on the moon, and he was Belgian.
So now we're looking for $1 billion for Meow Meow Beans.
Yeah, well, look, Clubhouse is a really good example of why, as we move forward, we're at the beginning of the maturing of the market, I think, around data. The last year has been fantastic because people have begun to understand what we've been talking about in the abstract for the last decade or so, about that blurring of the line between the personal space, the private space, and the public space. Catherine's going to punch me remotely when I say it's like T.S. Eliot in the love song of J.L. for Prufrock, preparing a face to meet the faces that you meet and measuring out your life in coffee spoons. But that argument is now becoming easier to have with people. That discussion is becoming easier to have with people. As we saw with WhatsApp and Signal, the mass migration once people realized that WhatsApp, Facebook is a face-eating tiger company and they were about to eat people's faces again. And I think the focus on good governance and planning around what you're going to do with data and being able to communicate that has become even more important. What do you think?
Absolutely.
No, I totally agree. Okay. I think we can just wrap it up right there, you know?
Yeah.
The two of you are agreeing with me, therefore we're ending it right now. No, go on, Carrie.
Well, the one thing I also consider, and again, I think it's because my lens is both in data protection and in security, is that no one thought about threat models here. It is mind blowing, you know. So as I come at this from a woman, as a female, and thinking about these things like harassment, you know, that thing. And to me, it struck me as so odd that you have this system where anybody that's on the Clubhouse thing can just send you heavy breathing or whatever. And there's not really any controls in place. Now, I've seen some assurances that that sort of a thing doesn't happen and that there's some, you know, acceptance things, but we have a hard enough time with dick pics on LinkedIn and Twitter that we don't need this. Like, this is just, it just makes my head hurt, you know, and there's no, and again, there was a, you know, acknowledgement that, you know, you can get in and start listening to some of the audio because, again, none of it's encrypted. And I'm just thinking to myself, oh, God, no one learns and no one is thinking about these things. And this is just going to end up it's going to end up worse than Zoom somehow. I'm just waiting for that to actually occur.
And in fairness to Zoom, while it's not perfect, it has improved significantly in the last 12 months in terms of its controls, because they had to learn that this idea of minimum viable product doesn't really cut it anymore when you're dealing with essentially regulated data, which is any data relating to living individuals. So I coined the phrase minimum liable product on Twitter a few weeks ago. Deborah Farber, Michelle Denny, think it's the term to use. Because what we're trying to measure there is the minimum liability you're willing to accept and that your investors are willing to accept as you roll your product out in early stages. And that's the key challenge we're trying to balance there. Okay, guys, we touched on a couple of things. We touched on Brexit. We touched on adequacy. We've touched on Clubhouse. We've talked about governance and data management. Quick closing statement from you both.
Things are getting messy right now. And so you really, again, need to do your due diligence. You need to make sure you have your governance in place. And yeah, you need to be forward thinking and consider what your risk appetite is. So that's really, I think, my lessons here.
Yeah. Carrie?
So I think my lessons learned are, or things that I would suggest folks think about is, you know, to not trust so much and not assume that things are just going to get worked out, to be a little pessimistic. I guess I have a Tim Turner mindset about certain things. I think learning from some of the bad things that we've had to deal with, the Solar Winds attacks, you know, the endless, you know, issues around, Zoom and probably Clubhouse and all these other things. I think we really need to learn from this. I think regulators need to start stepping up a little bit and, you know, maybe putting some ban hammers in place. I think that and, some people walking, you know, using their feet to make decisions in terms of purchases. Those are going to be the ways that people start to, and businesses in particular, start to realize why privacy is important. And so I think it's going to get there. I agree with Catherine entirely that we are in a bit of a bumpy stage, but I think enough things are starting to happen that new behaviors may be coming around and maybe crystallizing. So I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I think that we may be beginning to come to a point where investors will be asking early stage startups who have a minimal viable product, what percentage of the funding they're asking for on the cap table is going to be ring fenced and set aside to cover cost of liability and litigation if the underlying product is wrong? Because if they don't ask about that up front, the lesson we're learning is you have to find that money 6 months into your scale up to completely re-architect and rebuild your product from the ground up. If you don't do that and make that investment early on. So you're either going to have to plan to pay penalties, plan to do it right, or plan to rip it all out and start from scratch while you have customers on board.
Yeah.
And none of those are nice situations to be in. It's much better from a quality systems perspective to plan what you want to do, to understand the environment you're operating in, and just take the time and effort to build it right from the beginning, because it's much easier than having to rip it all out and start again. And the conversations that I've been having over the past few weeks with startups in Ireland, the number of innovative startups who want to actually take the time and effort to get this stuff right from the beginning is improving.
What is also the law? You know, there's that whole GDPR thing about data privacy by design. And, yeah. You know, it's kind of a thing.
There's the law and then there's doing it. And we're now beginning to see people starting to do it, which I think is a significant change. And we're beginning to see investors starting to look for it as well.
Right.
Okay. Well, that's it for today's podcast. Thank you very much to Catherine and Carrie. And also thank you to my family who sat here by the side of the road with me while we did the recording. Join us again next month.
You were listening to the Castle Ridge Talk Data to Me podcast. Thanks to my co-hosts in this episode, Catherine O'Keefe and Carrie Lenning. Join us again next month for more ramblings through the wonderful world of data management.